Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this hour's reading of the Triangle Business Journal on the biz page as normal. And under the heading of changes comes the article, New Firm Nabbing Talent in Commercial Real Estate. Moss Withers rocked the boat at NAI Carolinic Realty when he left the company in November to open a new brokerage in Raleigh. Another round of hires by the company is making more waves. Withers' new Lee & Associates office is gathering talent from around the region, adding brokers who had long-standing ties to previous companies. Of the firm's 8 employees, 6 were brokers from NAI Carolinic. Another is a longtime employee of Trademark Properties. Managing Director Brian Farmer is leaving after 2 decades with the firm to join Lee & Associates' Raleigh office. Joining Farmer are NAI Carolinic veterans Jake Plotkin, Scott Hadley, Hunter Stewart, and Russell Stewart, many of them with more than a decade at their prior firm. According to its website, NAI Carolinic has 16 brokers and employees after the exodus, including Chairman Stephen Stroud. Withers opened Lee & Associates' Triangle office last month after rising over the last decade to be one of NAI Carolinic's top brokers worldwide. Farmer says he decided to make the leap because he wanted to work under a national company. Because we're part of a flag, there will be more opportunity to work with office landlords and tenants, Farmer says. And under the heading of No Kidding comes the article, Breaking News, Raleigh and Durham are actually separate. Here at Biz, we have all the respect in the world for news reporters who have to go out in the snow and report on tough conditions. But we did chuckle at a reporter from the Weather Channel who was in town during the recent snow. The reporter noted, the way the Raleigh-Durham area works is Durham has their own county under the same name, and right here in Raleigh, we are under Wake County. So Raleigh and Durham are in different counties? Who knew? Does that mean Washington, D.C. is not in Virginia? And under the heading of Ranked comes the article, Here's What We Searched For in 2018. If you were at work searching for news on Demi Lovato in 2018, you weren't the only one. Google just announced its top trends and searches for 2018. In other words, the biggest jumps in traffic as compared to a year ago. Hurricanes and stunning deaths topped the search list for 2018 for both the United States and the Triangle. The deaths of Mac Miller, Kate Spade, Anthony Bourdain, and Aretha Franklin all made both the local and national list. Hurricane Florence led the Raleigh region and was second nationally, reflecting the intensity of the storm. Hurricane Michael was third in this area but didn't scratch the national top 10. But Lovato made both, as anxious followers checked in on her romantic life and her struggles with substance abuse. And under the heading of Highlighted comes the article, Top Microsoft Exec Touts Cary Firm at Conference. Cary's Epic Games had a high-profile visitor this month, Phil Spencer, Executive Vice President for Gaming at Microsoft. He mentioned the trip when he spoke at Barclays Global Technology, Media, and Communications Conference on December 5th. If you think about content transformation, technology transformation, and business model transformation, and they're all happening simultaneously, the really good example is a game, huge game right now called Fortnite, Spencer said. Spencer said Microsoft has worked with Epic Games for years and added, they started this game on PC. What you have today is a game that natively runs on phone devices, on PC, on console. All your players play together, which requires technology to connect those players. And on the heading of On the Record comes the article, Hurricanes Owner Would Prefer a Downtown Address. As Wake County enters critical discussions about PNC Arena, the Carolina Hurricanes owner is making his preference clear. I've never talked to any other markets about what's out there, Tom Dundon said December 12th at a Triangle Business Journal Power Breakfast. But we have a challenge, which is we're not downtown, and there's not a list of successful non-downtown arenas. If a downtown stadium is possible, he said, I'm in. I'd be happy to put up the money, to put up an environment, create a community, but here it's tough, he said. Dundon said he hasn't considered next steps if PNC Arena is not improved. You have to have an NHL-quality arena to have an NHL-quality team. I subsidize the team right now, and I'm okay with it. It's just how much and how long, he said. Dundon said losing about $10 million a year may be his limit, and he could lose maybe $20 million this year. I don't see a scenario where I'm trying to make money off this city. It's the exact opposite. I'm trying to figure out how much will I subsidize, he said. And finally, on the biz page, under the heading Fresh Approach, comes an article, New Waiting Area at Cary Hospital Tries to Mimic Hotel. Hospital waiting rooms aren't exactly known as places you want to lounge around, but WakeMed Cary sought to change that recently with a major upgrade of its lobby. WakeMed Cary opened to December 16, 1991, with a total of 80 beds, but the market has changed dramatically since then. The western part of Wake County has seen astonishing growth and rising competition in the hospital space as the major healthcare players in the market look to service that growing community. WakeMed Cary itself has grown to 178 beds, 1,135 employees, and a medical staff of 810 people. WakeMed Cary decided to do a major upgrade of its lobby and waiting area and tried to look at how patients and their families are using the space. The hospital opened the new space with tables, spaces for laptops, and even a cell phone charging station on October the 7th. The space also includes areas for more privacy. We were taking a different approach, says Patricia Gotchall, project manager at WakeMed Health and Hospitals. We were taking the approach of making it more of a hospitality experience for the patients and families, and really focusing on how rooms have changed, especially in that area. Gotchall says the response so far has been positive. I've heard that we've stepped it up, which is a good thing, she says. I heard a guy talking on the phone, and he said, I've been to WakeMed Cary for a long time, and it's like a high-end hotel. Next, we turn to the banking and technology page, and under the heading of reductions comes the article, again, Qualcomm serves notice of deep cuts in Raleigh. 6 months after notifying the state of 241 layoffs, chipmaker Qualcomm has disclosed another round, one that impacts 144 employees at its Raleigh office. According to a December 6 notice signed by William Saylor, senior vice president and legal counsel with Qualcomm, the company is reducing its workforce at its Raleigh office located at 8041 Arco Corporate Drive. Terminations are expected to begin February the 6th, and all impacted employees have been notified, states the filing submitted to the NC Department of Commerce. San Diego-based Qualcomm didn't respond to a request to comment on the cuts. In a statement at the time it announced layoffs in June, Qualcomm had said it remained committed to data center opportunities and is not divesting the assets. Qualcomm had opened its Triangle office in Cary in 2003 with just 4 people, developing a high-end smartphone technology called Snapdragon. The company no longer releases an updated headcount and has confirmed multiple cuts over the years. And under the heading of customer acquisition comes the article, Changes Abound in Area Branch Banking Scene. The branch banking landscape is changing in the Triangle, recent regulatory filings show. Global banking giant J.P. Morgan Chase's plans for its first 2 retail branches in the Triangle are materializing. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, part of the U.S. Department of the Treasury, officially handed down its approval November 27th for the 2 branches, to be located in Chapel Hill at West Franklin Street's Carolina Square and in Raleigh off Wake Forest Road. It's part of a plan the bank announced in January to open 400 branches in 5 years, but details have been sparse. We are not in some major markets like the Carolinas, but hope to be soon, bank spokesman Michael Fusco said in an email. We're still confirming our plans and we'll share more details as soon as we can. But application paperwork provided by the OCC at the behest of a public records request show plans for 2 fully staffed branches. And J.P. Morgan isn't alone. Raleigh's First Citizens Bank is moving forward with plans for a new 2-story branch in Durham set to open in late spring. and separate regulatory filings December the 7th with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the North Carolina Commissioner of Banks Office, the $35 billion bank outlined its intent to establish a new branch at 5417 Page Road. The 10,000-square-foot facility, according to what the bank told the NCCOB, will be known as the RTP branch, although it's just east of Research Triangle Park's borders. Bank spokesman Frank Smith says that when it opens, the current RTP branch at 5,200 square feet will relocate to the new facility from its current spot on 22 Park Drive, less than 2 miles away. As of June 30th, the bank had 8 branches in the Durham Metro, which includes Chapel Hill. It had nearly 3.6% of the Metro's deposits share. Its branch count has remained relatively consistent. In 2008, First Citizens had 7 branches in the Metro. Altogether, First Citizens operates 31 branches throughout the Triangle, according to the bank. Now, with this article, there are a couple of bar graphs. One of it is entitled Wagon Strength, and basically it's just a count of the number of branches present for, in this specific case, Wells Fargo. And featuring the years 2014 to 2018, it shows that in 2014, 15, and 16, there were 45 branches for Wells Fargo, and in 17 and 18, there are 44. The other graphic that's present with this article is a graphic entitled Piece of the Pie, and it's detailing the banks with the largest deposit share. And so I'll read to you the name of the bank and then the deposit breakdown in terms of the percentage share. Wells Fargo Bank has the largest at 22.34%, Pacific Western Bank 14.27%, BB&T 12.93%, Bank of America 11.17%, SunTrust Bank 8.39%, First Citizens Bank 8.36%, PNC Bank 7.3%, First Tennessee Bank 2.04%, Paragon Bank 1.72%, and finally FNB of Pennsylvania 1.71%. Finally, on the banking technology page this week, under the heading Green Currents, comes the article, to get Amazon's attention, Chatham County offered $169 million in incentives. Chatham County was willing to offer Amazon nearly $169 million in incentives for the 50,000 jobs it hoped HQ2 might bring to Chatham Park. That's according to newly released public records from Chatham County, further outlining the region's massive, albeit failed, effort to recruit the mega project that was later announced for Northern Virginia and New York. Officials in Chatham County, who had already lobbied unsuccessfully for the Toyota project last year, saw Amazon as the perfect tenant for Chatham Park, the massive development near Pittsboro being planned by Preston Development. The key was selling the site's potential, officials said in emails. In a pitch outline to Amazon dated October of 2017, it was noted that with Chatham Park, Amazon could be a key force in shaping the character of the community as it emerges over the next several decades. And Chatham Park had the flexibility to either sell land to Amazon or lease space and buildings that Chatham Park would build suit, the county said, in a proposal spearheaded by then-economic developer director Kyle Touchstone. Chatham Park is only the beginning and has the capacity to channel its growth in any number of ways, the proposal states. Chatham Park invites Amazon to collaborate with us over the long term in our pursuit of the perfect community. On January 18, Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina received an email from Amazon. Raleigh had made the shortlist. And the email trail from Chatham County trickled off, with the state shifting much of its focus toward marketing Raleigh proper for the project. Next, we turn to the real estate page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of Done Deal comes the article, Chicago Firm Closes on Purchase of New Syneos HQ. As Syneos Health began moving its employees into the company's new headquarters in Morrisville, a Chicago real estate investment firm was busy finalizing a long-planned deal to buy the property. Capri EGM has completed the acquisition of the 258,000-square-foot building known as Perimeter 5, paying $74.2 million. The firm had previously signed on as a partner in the development, injecting capital in April to help carry it over the finish line. At the time, Capri EGM officials said they planned to acquire the building upon completion. That transaction is now complete, even as Cineo's employees are still settling into their new desks. This is Capri EGM's first acquisition in the Triangle, but likely not the last. CEO Shelby Pruitt says the company has been focusing on fast-growing metros, similar to the Triangle, such as Austin, Texas. "We're looking in very strong, tech-centric markets," Pruitt says. The company's already on the lookout for more construction buys in the region. And under the heading of home sales, the article, "Increases seen in Durham and Chapel Hill home prices." Home prices in the Durham-Chapel Hill metro area increased more than the national average in October, while Raleigh's home price appreciation was slightly below average. That's according to the latest housing index report from real estate data firm CoreLogic, which shows price increases rising at a slower rate across the country. Nationwide, home prices rose 5.2% on average in October, compared to the same month last year. For Durham and Chapel Hill, the increase was 5.6%. Raleigh saw an increase of 4.6%. While prices continue to rise in the Triangle and across the country, housing analysts say that the sustained rise in home prices, coupled with increasing mortgage rates, is leading to fewer home purchases. It also could be dampening prices. CoreLogic predicts nationwide home price increases to slow to 4.6% by next October. Rising prices and interest rates have reduced home buyer activity and led to a gradual slowing in appreciation, stated CoreLogic chief economist Frank Notheft. And under the heading of development comes the article, $40 million plus Bengal Town Center starts its prowl in Fuquay Arena. Construction crews have descended on a chunk of vacant and lightly treed farmland north of downtown Fuquay Arena, beginning work on what will someday be a walkable, mixed-use development 1 mile from downtown. Called Bengal Town Center, the project includes 53 townhomes and 6 parcels dedicated to commercial development that can rise as tall as 5 stories, with residential units or offices above ground floor retail space. All told, the mixed-use portion will total just under 270,000 square feet, with an estimated build-out cost of $40 million to $60 million, according to those working on the project. The name echoes the Bengal sports teams at Fuquay Arena High School. The complex is supposed to bring denser development to a corner of Wake County that has seen rapid growth in recent years. The whole idea of it is that the businesses would be in the town center, would be able to benefit from all the foot traffic, says Marguerite Green, a broker with Century 21 Triangle Group. They'd have a built-in customer base. Green's firm is handling the leasing and sales of the commercial parcels. The developer is Wiseman Plus Dev Company, a partnership that includes David Ball and Jim Miner. The company bought the 21-acre parcel in September for $3 million. On property to the south, construction is underway on a 432-unit apartment community called The Retreat at Fuquay Arena. The townhomes at the Bengal Town Center are being built by Royal Oaks, a division of Matamy Homes. That's Matamy Homes. Royal Oaks' Rich Van Tassel estimates the price range will be between $250,000 and $300,000. And under the heading of sold comes the article, "Condo Project Near Cameron Village Attracts New Owner." A new developer specializing in high-end homes has bought a condominium project near Cameron Village. Legacy Custom Homes paid $5.5 million for the 904 Oberlin development on Oberlin Road near the intersection with Van Dyke Avenue, buying it from Chad Stelmach. Stelmach pitched the development more than 2 years ago as a high-end condo community, built as a series of townhomes, with prices starting in the 900,000s. The city approved Stelmach's plans in 2016, but the project was slow to get underway. The sale was finalized this month with none of the units complete and just 6 currently under construction. Legacy Custom Homes President Ward Russell says his firm saw the project as an opportunity to expand on a model that has worked for them. The firm has built high-end condos elsewhere in town, including the Oakwood Towns project under construction north of downtown Raleigh. Russell also touted the location. It's a four-minute walk to Cameron Village, he says. Stelmach didn't return calls for comment, but Russell says condos weren't Stelmach's specialty. Stelmach's Kimberly Development Group has done more commercial work, according to its website. And finally, on the real estate page, under the heading of Cashing In, comes the article, Raleigh's Terramore Homes Sold to D.R. Horton for $60 million. A Raleigh home building company has sold to a national firm that already has a substantial presence in the Triangle, adding yet another high-profile local firm to the list of companies being acquired in the home building market. The owners of Terramore Homes have closed a deal valued at approximately $60 million to sell to D.R. Horton, one of the largest builders in the country, according to a statement from the Fort Worth, Texas-based company. Before the acquisition, D.R. Horton was already among the top builders in the Triangle, ranking fourth through the third quarter, with 427 annual new home starts in the region, according to Metro Study. Terramore ranked 13th with 223 new home starts. With the acquisition, D.R. Horton will retain its position in the rankings, but jump much closer to Dan Ryan Builders, currently third with 721 annual starts. As part of the deal, D.R. Horton gains control of Terramore's 305 lots, 156 homes in inventory, and 63 homes in sales order backlog, according to the company. Under the terms of the deal, Terramore co-founder Pablo Reiter will operate Terramore as a separate division. The deal is an unfamiliar territory for Reiter, who was involved with a similar acquisition in the past. In 2006, Reiter sold a previous home building company he co-owned called Capital Homes to Comstock Home Building Companies. Home sales have begun to slow down in parts of the country, and there is evidence of the market softening in the Triangle. Now we turn to the life sciences and education pages of this week's Triangle Business Journal. Under the heading of Adding Cash comes the article, Red Hill Closes $20 Million Offering, Eyes Commercial Launch of New Drug. Red Hill Biopharma has closed on a $20 million public offering to fund the commercial launch of its drug, Talicia, which means expansion of the company's Raleigh team. The public offering opened December 4th for nearly 2.9 million American depositary shares at a price of $7 per share. Each ADS represents 10 ordinary shares of Red Hill. The company has also granted the underwriters a 30-day option to purchase up to 428,571 additional shares at the public offering price. Talicia is a treatment for Helicobacter pylori infection. Earlier in December, the company announced positive top-line results from a confirmatory Phase 3 study. Worldwide, the market for H. pylori therapies was about $4.83 billion as of 2015. Red Hill is an Israel-based pharmaceutical company that opened a U.S. headquarters in Raleigh in 2017. Its commercial operations are based in Raleigh. CEO Dror Ben-Asher says approval of the drug could lead to a significant increase in its Raleigh team, but exact numbers have not been determined. He says the majority of the funding from the round will be used for bolstering its commercial capabilities, including the new hires. Additionally, he says the company's in the market for acquisitions. In particular, we're looking to add new FDA-approved gastrointestinal drugs to our commercial team's basket, he says. Ben-Asher says the company plans to submit its new drug application in the coming months. Because Talicia is fast-tracked by the FDA as a high-priority program, it's eligible for a short 6-month review, meaning approval could come in the first half of 2019. That approval would result in 8 years of market exclusivity. He says the company plans to launch commercialization plans by the second half of the coming year. In addition to Talicia, some of the funding will be used for the Phase 3 studies of RHB-204 and RHB-104. And under the heading of Targeting Triangle comes the article, UNC Healthcare Raising Minimum Wage for Employees. UNC Healthcare is planning a $15 million increase to its hourly employee budget, putting those dollars back into Triangle area workers' pockets. The health system recently announced its intention to raise the minimum wage for its Triangle area employees to $15 per hour by July of 2020. Currently, all minimum wage employees make at least $12 an hour. About 3,750 UNC Health employees in the Triangle work between the $12 and $15 threshold. The system has about 21,500 Triangle employees. Also, the wages of hourly employees already making $15 per hour or more will be adjusted. About 5,000 employees meet that criteria, meaning the decision will increase the wages of about 9,000 employees in the Triangle. Dr. Bill Roper, CEO of UNC Healthcare, said, "We are proud to employ the best people to fulfill our mission of caring for patients and their families, and offering a higher living wage is an important step we are able to take." The adjustment will happen incrementally. On January the 13th, the minimum wage will rise to $14 per hour. Officials say discussions are underway regarding increasing the minimum wage outside the Triangle and other UNC Health-affiliated hospitals. Officials said the Triangle's higher cost of living, strong job market, and competition for talented co-workers are key factors in the decision to make a living wage adjustment now. And in other news from the Life Sciences Education page comes the article, "Duke Acquires 10,000 Acres for Carbon Farm." Duke University has partnered with an Eastern North Carolina landowner to begin work on what could be the largest carbon farm in the country. The university recently announced it's acquired the rights to 10,000 acres of land in Hyde County, owned by Hyde County Partners, LLC. The university plans to adapt the Pocosin peatlands, formerly drained for agriculture, into a carbon farm and conservation area, which could propel the university to carbon neutrality by 2024. Carbon farming is a relatively new approach to fighting climate change that uses land management and conservation to increase the amount of carbon that agriculture pulls out of the air and locks into the soil and vegetation. If successful, the plot has the potential to be the largest carbon plant on the East Coast or even the country. Curtis Richardson, director of the Duke University Wetland Center, who spearheaded efforts to broker the deal, said based on Duke research, Pocosins are specifically advantageous for carbon farming. A five-year study we did at Pocosin Lakes National Wildlife Refuge in nearby Terrell County showed that these peatlands have some of the highest net carbon credit values ever recorded, he says. Existing carbon farming programs in California, the Midwest, and other countries have shown that a 2.5-acre plot of pasture or rangeland can store about 1 metric ton of carbon annually. Richardson says these peatlands, once re-wetted, have much greater potential, perhaps 15 to 20 times more, meaning the land could yield hundreds of thousands of metric tons of carbon annually. Currently, the university is beginning a pilot program on 300 of the acres, but plans to expand its work if it sees similar results as the Pocosin Lakes study. He said the university has already spent about $300,000 on the project, but would be eliciting donations, selling carbon credits to companies, or finding other sources of revenue to expand their work. Also on the Life Sciences Education page comes the article, "Chapel Hill Pharma Adds Partners and Seeks Global Reach." Chapel Hill-based Target Pharma Solutions is wrapping up 2018 with a pair of new partnerships, further pushing the fast-developing company toward what its CEO says will be a better 2019. In December, the clinical data company announced strategic partnerships with Gilead Sciences and Bristol-Myers Squibb to expand its research work. Gilead is the first partner to join the company's Target Hepatitis B study. It will also be entering the Target NASH study, and NASH stands for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Bristol-Myers, which has an existing partnership with the company's NASH and cancer studies, will be expanding the partnership to include its Target IBD, that's inflammatory bowel disease, study. The partnerships are the 13th and 14th agreements the company has contracted with pharmaceutical companies since kicking off in early 2016. CEO Meg Powell declined to disclose the details of each partnership, but described them both as multi-year relationships. Target completed its Series A round funding in March of 2016, raising $2 million with Rex Health Ventures as the lead investor. Since then, it has partnered with pharmaceutical giants such as Allergan, Intercept, Boehringer Ingelheim, and Novartis. Target was acquired by California private equity firm Norwest Venture Partners in May, but Powell says the acquisition has not affected the pharma's business model or customer relationships. She says the company has 63 employees in the Triangle, and it plans to expand its headcount to at least 80 by the end of 2019. Our goal is to be a global authority on real-world evidence, Powell says. Now we turn to the restaurants and retail pages of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of Good Advice comes the article, Hospitality Leaders Assess Competitive Market. As 2018 comes to an end, it's time to reflect on local restaurants here in the Triangle. With a great influx of new local restaurants popping up in the area, especially in Durham, here's what two leaders have to say as to why some restaurants flourish while others do not survive. Don Ball, Director of Food and Beverage at the Washington Duke Inn in Durham, and Anthony Carey, General Manager at a little Palio restaurant in Chapel Hill, answered some of these questions. Why can it be difficult for local restaurants to last for years, especially in places such as Durham, where new restaurants are springing up so often? And they both respond. Ball's response, Durham is such a vibrant center, but there's also a lot of competition. There are a lot more places to eat in downtown Durham than there used to be. At least to me, it seems there are more restaurants opening than people moving to town. Carey's response, there are a couple reasons we see so many restaurants open and close within a few years. The idea of owning a restaurant is exciting and fun, but the reality is it's really hard work. Plus, there's a limited supply of talented staff. We don't have enough talented line level and management staff to operate the restaurants in the Triangle, and comping friends and staff could make costs quickly go out of control. But at any upscale restaurant in the Triangle, it's still up to an hour wait on the weekend. Ball's response, I still think the prime times of Thursday through Saturday are going to be busy, but those shoulder days of Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday are when people need to put butter on their bread. Those are the days for competition for the customer's dollar or at high stakes. I think that's what's changed in our market. It's how we used to be a sleepy southern town that wasn't known for its food, but some of the older restaurants that aren't with us anymore brought a reputation to the area. Also, new restaurants have opened, and they've raised the bar, providing very high-quality food. Upscale restaurants such as Il Palio and the Washington Duke's Fairview have operated for years. What advice do you have for a young chef or restaurant owner? Carey responds, make sure you understand the staffing challenges and the transient nature of the restaurant business. Staff come and go quickly, so have a plan to handle the unexpected turnover. I've seen more opening restaurants lure staff away by paying them way more than the market average. And location, location, location. Finally, what about special events? Will more restaurants feature more special events to get people in the door, such as wine dinners and fundraisers? Ball responds, yes. You need to bring in new customers, but at the same time, keeping your existing customers interested provides a creative outlet for the guest experience and for the kitchen. Passion breeds passion, so when that enthusiasm comes across, the guest experience is higher. Now, if you listen to Triangle Business Journal regularly, you know that there's always a cover story article. This week's Triangle Business Journal is a little different, and it has the 2018 Business Person of the Year under the heading Perpetual Optimist. And it features Sepide Saidi. Now, Sepide is usually referred to as Seppi, and that's the way it's referred to most frequently in this article. Seppi Saidi was 15 years old when she saw Raleigh for the first time through the window of a plane. From 35,000 feet, it looked to the young Saidi as if she were descending into the middle of a forest. The year was 1978. And Saidi was touching down as a high school transfer student from Iran, where she was raised in the country's bustling capital of Tehran. Like many Iranian students from her peer group, Saidi's family sent her to America for a better education, following the path of her oldest brother, then a college student at NC State University. She knew little about the town below, how it would shape her or the ways in which she would contribute to his future. Mostly, she felt excited. Then the Iranian Revolution swept through Saidi's country from 1978 to 1979. Facing an unstable political landscape back home, Saidi and her family decided she would stay in the U.S., where she began studying at NC State. "We didn't have time to feel sorry for ourselves," she says. Saidi, 56, still doesn't have time for pessimism. She's built a career by looking toward the future, by forcing her optimistic outlook onto uncertain circumstances. Since her early days as an immigrant in Raleigh with few connections to the city, Saidi has gone on to found one of the region's fastest-growing companies while taking leadership positions with some of the Triangle's most prominent nonprofits and government organizations. These accomplishments have earned her Triangle Business Journal's 2018 Business Person of the Year Award. Saidi's optimism could be seen in the early days of her business when she quit a comfortable government job and founded SEPI Engineering in 2001 with a home equity loan and no employees. It carried her through the Great Recession when the government contract she used to build her company suddenly dried up. Instead of focusing on what was missing, Saidi explored new opportunities, military base renovations, erosion, and grading control for the burgeoning solar industry. "Imagining the terrible things that can happen is so much easier," she says. "Envisioning success is difficult, but that's what Saidi has done." With new revenue streams, payroll reached 195 employees by 2015, and the company only continues to grow. This year, SEPI Engineering has an employee count of more than 300 and revenue that will approach $40 million. Meanwhile, Saidi has taken positions on the boards of the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce and Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority, among other organizations, adding an entrepreneurial mindset and an engineer's touch to institutions shaping the future of the Triangle and the state. Saidi's father was a lawyer and held a position in Iran's corporate world, but the female role models in her family life were just as strong. Her grandmother was a high school principal. There were very equal expectations, she says. With those standards in mind, Saidi opted to study engineering at NC State and eventually landed a job at the North Carolina Department of Transportation. Her time at the agency laid the groundwork for a career spanning planning infrastructure projects and navigating government contracts. It also taught her how to succeed in a male-dominated industry in the South. "When I was at DOT, I was the most non-typical person they could be around," Saidi says, "and I decided to find a way to connect and build relationships with people who initially I thought I had nothing in common with." That meant becoming genuinely interested in the cultural backgrounds of her colleagues. She recalls learning about dove and deer hunting from her co-workers, both unfamiliar practices for a woman who grew up in a vibrant city in Iran. Sandra Stepney was one of the few women who worked with Saidi at NCDOT in the 1990s. She remembers an outgoing colleague who's warm but confident. "For that day and that time, she was outspoken," Stepney says. Stepney served as Saidi's supervisor in the roadway design unit, where she oversaw a crew of 15 who spent their days poring over the details of transportation plans. While leaving was not something that people did, it wasn't necessarily out of character for the women Stepney had grown to know. "The traditions of those before us was to typically do 30 years, said Stepney, who retired this summer after more than three decades with NCDOT. "You put in your 30 years, you retire, then you go to work in the private sector." But not Saidi. SEPI was always looking for ways to expand, ways to grow, Stepney says. The relationships and experiences Saidi gained in state governments proved crucial as she struck out on her own. The vast majority of her company's early business was contracts with her former agency, designing and planning transportation infrastructure. Even today, Saidi estimates that 60% of her business comes from NCDOT contracts. But thriving as a civil engineering firm, and not just surviving, has required taking new risks. Barbara Mulkey has been running her own namesake engineering firm for nearly a decade when Saidi founded her company. "I thought that SEPI was ambitious," Mulkey says. There were few women in the industry. Both Mulkey and Saidi focused on projects awarded through a federal program that dedicates contracts to women-owned small businesses. That was enough to sustain a company's early growth, but only to a point. Like Mulkey, Saidi had her sights set on more. Only women-owned businesses of a certain size qualify for the program. If a company grows past that threshold, they are on their own. Small fish and a suddenly large pond of national engineering firms vying for the same projects. Like Mulkey before her, Seppi Engineering took that plunge, surpassing the $17 million threshold 4 years ago. Making the leap required concerted planning by the firm, ensuring the company could compete with larger players while also pursuing new business opportunities. The challenge is, where do you grow beyond $17 million, Saidi says. Then you start competing with $100 million companies, and that's not necessarily an easy thing to do. In my industry, there are many companies that are very large. They're great companies, but they are significantly stronger. To compete, Saidi says she relied on the expertise of her staff. Even from the early stages of her business, she focused on spending the extra money to hire top talent. At the end of the day, it's the individuals you have, the engineers and professionals you have on your team that are producing the projects, she says. If the quality you're producing is equal to everyone else, there's no reason it should matter. Saidi also has always had a keen eye for new avenues that could be added to her business, such as environmental planning. She's had the courage to branch out more than some in her industry, Mulkey says. Seppi seizes opportunities, and she's got the courage to take the risk. She's surpassed anything that I ever did. Maintaining control of the company enables her to take those risks. In Mulkey's case, she shared ownership early on with her staff and a play to make the company's work more of a team effort. But that meant diluting decision-making power, often sharing it with engineers who were more averse to risk-taking. Saidi's decision to keep control has allowed her to be more entrepreneurial, which is a natural fit for her, Mulkey says. In the early days of the company, Seppi Engineering was a one-woman show, operating out of an office over Saidi's garage in Cary, where she was raising two children, Nikizi and Bardia, now 27 and 23. Even in the beginning, Saidi says she wasn't too concerned about failing. As a licensed engineer, she had the cushion of knowing her skill set was in demand if she needed a salaried position. From the beginning, she's focused on growth. My goal and vision was to grow the company, and I knew we were going to exceed the small business threshold because that was my strategy, she says. Today, she owns an 88% ownership stake and is already planning the company's next move. In 2019, she wants to expand into wastewater planning services for municipalities, a business she sees growing in the near future, as North Carolina continues to grow and urbanize. Further on the horizon, Saidi's thinking even more broadly. She wants to rebrand the company as a consulting firm. Even though all the growth Saidi had fostered, the firm's new office space on the sixth floor of One Glenwood is a significant move for a company that deals chiefly in the mucky details of development and has been in the same office space for more than a decade. Part of the appeal of being downtown is that it puts employees closer to City Hall and the offices of NCDOT. About half of her staff works in construction inspection, overseeing NCDOT projects. But for Saidi, the move is mostly about building a company where people want to work. Attracting talent is key in the engineering industry where qualified employees are in demand and difficult to come by. I feel like it's going to bring the company together, Saidi says. In her early days, she was able to sell her company to potential employees as a place where they could have some freedom. They were attracted to my vision because I believe in hiring really great people and letting them do their thing. Letting them be entrepreneurial and supporting them, Saidi says. But she's also open to embracing the changes brought on by the next generation of employees. Her children call her a wannabe millennial, she says. She uses WhatsApp and Instagram and says she's excited about the open office layout in the new space. Saidi also acknowledges there will be challenges. Traditionally, the location of a person's office indicates status, but that will be turned on its head in the open layout. Saidi's commitment to employees runs deeper than just office design. A few years ago, company leadership came up with a new strategic goal called 50 and 5, with the goal of generating $50 million in annual revenue within 5 years. But setting the company's vision on such a narrow monetary target didn't sit well with some employees. Saidi listened to the feedback from workers who felt the company was too focused on a dollar amount at the expense of quality and client and employee satisfaction. So Sapi Engineering scrapped the old plan and came up with a new one. Vision 2021, a much broader set of goals the company is aiming to reach on its 20th anniversary. Saidi has brought another message to her employees as well, that diversity makes a company stronger. She has preached that message in her own executive suite and in the boardrooms of other organizations. So, the RDU Airport Authority Board, on the RDU Airport Authority Board, Saidi serves as the only woman, and RDU CEO Michael Langoth says she's been a key voice in advocating for the inclusion piece. That means speaking out for more diversity in the employees that the airport hires and its partners and contractors. She's trying to emulate that with her business and thinks the authority should do the same thing, he says. Promoting inclusion is a philosophy she believes in, but it's also good business. Attracting and retaining talent is key in the engineering industry, Saidi says, and diverse applicants don't want to work in an office where they don't feel connected or represented. She believes it's only become more important to get that message across as the political discourse surrounding immigrants and Muslims has become more vitriolic. It's just hard to see that we're not embracing others who are coming to add value, Saidi says. At a meeting of the company's diversity committee recently, Saidi described to employees the way she views the U.S. as the birthplace of the entrepreneurial immigrant. After all, she arrived 4 decades ago as a young teenager, then used a combination of wits and warmth to rise to success while retaining a touch of Tehran in her speech. So don't shy away from your cultural backgrounds in the workplace, she tells a group. If I have an accent, you can have an accent, she says. It's okay. Now we turn to the executive voice of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and that voice belongs to John Enberg. Durham native John Enberg was deployed on multiple tours with the U.S. Navy and studied at Harvard University before returning to the Triangle to lead the regional office of fast-growing tech company Opendoor. The startup is trying to upend the home selling market by offering to pay cash for homes with little hassle to the owner. The early results show there's interest. From its launch in the Triangle at the beginning of the year through the third quarter, Opendoor bought more than 500 homes and sold nearly 200 in Durham, Wake, Orange, and Johnson counties. Meanwhile, the company continues to expand to cities across the country while raising millions in financing from deep-pocketed backers. 3 months ago, Japanese conglomerate SoftBank Group Corp., the same group that has backed co-working giant WeWork, made a $400 million investment in Opendoor. Enberg is spearheading the job of explaining to the Triangle how this new model works and overseeing the company's growth here, all while navigating a housing market that is showing signs of softening. Here, he reveals how he wants Opendoor to expand and potentially change the industry. So here's the Q&A for Enberg. What was your first job out of college? After college, I served 8 years in the U.S. Navy, mostly on the West Coast with several deployments to the Middle East. How did you get into the real estate business? I've always loved architecture and circled around various aspects of the real estate world before landing there full-time. I studied civil engineering in college, and prior to Opendoor, I worked for a smart home startup. That experience taught me how unique each home and customer situation is, and that selling a home comes with a lot of uncertainty and stress. Those takeaways led me to my role at Opendoor. So what first drew you to the Triangle? I was born and raised in Durham, but moved around the country when in the military and during and after grad school. My wife and I returned to the Triangle because it's a great place to live and raise a family. What were your early perceptions of Opendoor? How did those change once you started working for the company? I joined Opendoor because I love the idea of combining technology with residential real estate to provide a valuable service for customers. The Opendoor team is smart, humble, and hungry to create something great. After joining, I realized there's an incredible amount of teamwork and complexity in the business, and that every single person who works at Opendoor is obsessed with giving our customers a wonderful experience at the best price. That's what I found most inspiring, simplifying a complicated process, and actually making it delightful for people who want to sell or buy. There's so much to improve when buying or selling your home, and it's exciting to be part of the shift. So what are the biggest misconceptions people in the Triangle have about Opendoor? That there's a catch. Our offers to buy homes are free and come with no obligation. Homeowners can request a cash offer at any time, come back as often as they wish, and cancel at any time without penalty. We think homeowners should always know the fair market value of their home if they had to sell it today. We're growing our work with local agents, not vice versa. Open Door is another tool in the toolbox for agent partners and an option they should consider for each of their clients. Ideally, an agent presents every seller with the option to list their home on the market or sell to Open Door. In the latter case, we pay the agent a referral fee. Some people think only one type of person sells to Open Door, when actually we have folks from all walks of life. We have 35 employees and dozens of vendors in the Triangle focused on helping every type of customer. So how would you summarize your business model? Open Door is putting the control of selling and buying back into the hands of our customers. For sellers, sell your home for fair market value without the hassle and uncertainty of listing. For buyers, browse, tour, and buy any Open Door home on your timeline. Open Door makes selling or buying a home as easy as trading a car. What's the best advice you ever received? Sisu. It's a Finnish word that roughly translates to grit, determination, and never give up. It was used a lot by my dad growing up and is a family motto. What do you do to relax? Exercise early in the morning. It clears my mind and preps me for the day. When you were 8 years old, what did you want to be when you grew up? The ACC commissioner. What books are on your nightstand? The Score Takes Care of Itself by former NFL coach Bill Walsh. The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday. High Output Management by Andy Grove. Goodnight, Goodnight Construction Site by Cheryl Dusty Rinker. Now, as we end this, come to the end of this week's Triangle Business Journal reading, we get to the viewpoint page of the week's TBJ. And the guest column this week is John Trump, who's managing editor of Carolina Journal. His editorial is entitled, 2 years Later, They All Looked Small. Here we are, 2 years later. We've taken many arduous, often tedious steps, only to return where we began, having gone nowhere. In late 2016, as Governor Roy Cooper was preparing to take office, the General Assembly decided it would change the makeup of the bipartisan Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement. Republicans lost the governorship, so it's tough to argue the move by GOP lawmakers wasn't an attempt to accumulate power, while at the same time removing power from the new governor, a Democrat. It didn't work. Maybe that's something lawmakers should have known. Nevertheless, we traveled hundreds of figurative miles and spent tens of thousands of real dollars on a perpetual roundabout. Starting, stopping, starting again, wait your turn, much like rush hour traffic on Hillsborough Street. Before state lawmakers' first attempt in 2016 to merge the state elections and ethics boards, state elections were administered by a five-member board. The governor's party held three seats. The other major political party held the other two. Lawmakers' first move 2 years ago was to create an eight-member board divided equally among Democratic and Republican appointees, the legislature picking all members. Cooper challenged the move on grounds that it violated separation of powers, and he won. Subsequent versions of the boards gave some power back to the governor and added a ninth unaffiliated member selected by the board. The courts didn't like those ideas either, any of them. A proposed state constitutional amendment to preserve changes to the Elections and Ethics Board failed in November. Although Superior Court decisions from October ruled the board unconstitutional, midterm election voting had already started. The court kept the board in place until December the 3rd, so back to start. Representative David Lewis, Republican of Harnett, on December the 3rd introduced House Bill 1117, which would reconfigure and split the bipartisan Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement. One element would be a five-member board overseeing the administration of elections. As with the original elections board, the governor would have control over appointments. Three of the five members would come from the governor's party. State leaders and the other majority party would nominate candidates for the two remaining spots. County election boards would return to three members instead of four, with no more than two members coming from the same party. In odd-numbered years, the chair would be a member of the political party with the highest number of registered party affiliates, currently the Democratic Party. During even-numbered years, the chair would be a member of the political party with the second highest number of registered party affiliates, now the Republican Party. A second element would be an eight-member bipartisan board addressing ethics, campaign finance, and lobbying. Half the members would be appointed by the governor, the other half by state lawmakers. Back to start. Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin and Michigan are making efforts to usurp power from their respective incoming governors, who are Democrats. National writers and pundits are comparing those efforts to similar moves by North Carolina Republicans 2 years ago. North Carolina wrote the playbook to undermine democracy, a headline on one national news website read. Andy Taylor, political science professor at NC State University, told Carolina Journal's Lindsay Marcello that it looks as if lawmakers are abandoning their quest for a bipartisan board of elections and ethics. If you're going back to what the 2016 status quo was, that seems as uncontroversial of a position as you can possibly get, Taylor said. So be it. The fact lawmakers and the governor, too, spent 2 years doing expensive circles isn't lost on us. It won't be lost on taxpayers and voters either. We certainly don't want more government, nor should we spend more time in court. It's time to, well, get real. At some point, we must stop governing and fighting solely for the sake of partisan labels. This 2-year quagmire over the Elections and Ethics Board was much like a mirror held up to all involved, and they all looked very small. Completing this week's editor's notebook is why we selected Seppi Saidi as our 2018 BPOY. Just like every year, it started with a list of names in late fall. From banking to commercial real estate to professional services and higher education, reporters and editors of TBJ put several names on the table with hope that every name would be vetted to its fullest by comparing the individual's accomplishments during the year and coupling that with their influence and commitment to the community in 2018. Discussions and deliberations went on for hours on certain days in October and early November as we talked about revenue, employee growth, local board actions, capital expenses, and several earlier topics. In the end, Seppi Saidi, owner of Seppi Engineering, stood out for a variety of reasons. Saidi's rise to being one of the most influential business people in the Triangle after landing in Raleigh from Iran is impressive as a role as the CEO and growing her 300-worker company. Somewhere down the line, Saidi also took up a new challenge to empower women in business in the Raleigh-Durham area. Nowadays, when you talk to her about women in business, that's when you see her most animated. We're thrilled to announce Seppi Saidi as our 2018 Business Person of the Year, and we can't wait to see the things she will do in the future for 2019. Well, that music means that we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.